လူတိုင်းကကိုယ်နားမလဲနိုင်ဘူးလူတိုင်းမှာသူတို့နားလဲနိုင်တဲ့အာဒီခံစားချက်တွေလူတိုင်းမှာနားလဲနိုင်တဲ့ကိုယ်ကူညီပေးနိုင်တဲ့အရေးချင်းမရှိဘူးပေါ့နော်အထူးသဖြင့်လူတိုင်းက clinically trained ထားတာမဟုတ်တဲ့အတွက်ကြောင့်မို့လို့ကျမတို့ကကိုယ့်ရဲ့အတွင်းရေးတွေကိုယ့်ရဲ့ခံစားချက်တွေလူတိုင်းကမပြောပြသင့်ဘူးပေါ့နော်ကိုမပိုင်တဲ့အရာကိုအတွက်အာလုတ်ပိုင်ခွင့်မရှိတဲ့အရာဆိုလို့ရှိရင်လည်းမလုတ်တာကအာအကောင်ဆုံးပဲဥပမာကျမတို့ဒီကောင်စလင်းမတော်မှလူတကာကကိုမသိဘူးလေနော်ကိုမသိတာမသိတဲ့အကြောင်းကိုမတက်ရင်မတက်တဲ့အကြောင်းကိုရဲ့ scope of practice ပေါ့နော်ကိုလေ့ကျင့်နေတဲ့အရာထက်ကြော်လွန်ပြီးတော့လုတ်တယ်ဆိုလို့ရှိရင်လည်းဒါကျင့်ဝတ်နဲ့မညီဘူကြတော့အခြေအနေတစ်ခုတူတူကြုံတွေ့ကြရတယ်ဒါပေမဲ့တယောက်မှတော့စိတ်ထင်ရပြီနောက်တယောက်မှစိတ်ထင်ရပါဘလို့မရတာလေလို့မေးမယ်ဆိုလို့ရှိရင်ဒီတယောက်ရဲ့ support system သူ့တိစောက်ထားတဲ့အရာတွေပေါ့နော်သူ့ရဲ့ belief system တွေရှိမယ်သူ့ကိုကာကွယ်ဆောင်ရှောက်ပေးတဲ့လူတွေသူ့ကိုသူမြင်တဲ့အမြင် self esteem တွေပေါ့နော်အဲ့ဒါတွေအပေါ်မှာလည်းမူတည်ရပါဘူး
Understand that for so many with ties to Myanmar, these past few years of conflict have left deep scars. It's more than understandable that many are now struggling with mental health and seeking balance in the face of unimaginable loss, pain, and violence. These challenges weigh heavily, yet they're also a testament to the human capacity to endure. To all those now listening who carry these burdens, we extend our heartfelt well wishes.May you find moments of peace amidst the chaos, strength to navigate the hardships, and hope to sustain you through the darkest times. You are not alone, and we stand with you in solidarity and compassion.
Hi, my name is Juju. I'm a social worker at Queens Medical Center in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I'm also a lecturer at University of Hawaii. So mainly I am would like to introduce to the Myanmar audience and international audience about Juju Safe Space, which is a mental health organization that provides mental health services for people of Myanmar inside Myanmar, Thailand, and the US. So we mainly provide the services in Burmese language. And we started as a Facebook page from 2019 just to share, you know, this mental health contents in Burmese language because it was very limited information about mental health in Burmese language.
Thank you for that introduction. And I think as we get to learn more about how this, what became a Facebook page, grew into something more of a community, even a movement, and bringing a certain kind of awareness to wider Burmese society in the country as well as outside in the diaspora,
I think your story is central to this. And so if we could back up and you can share your story of where you grew up and how you moved and then how your surrounding and conditioning started to shape you and your beliefs as you developed in this interest into later what we'll get into of what you started.
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, like I said, I'm a social worker and I believe in social justice. It's really rooted from my family because my dad is a political prisoner and he was 88th generation, fought for democracy. And my mom was also a social worker, worked for this nonprofit organization to help human trafficking, against human trafficking, and also children in Thai-Burma border. So because I grew up in this very politically active community, you know, I have seen very unjust things in the Burmese community in Thailand. So, you know, I grew up in Thailand. We moved there when I was about 13 years old because my dad left the country when I was really young and we met him again when I was 13. And when I was in Thailand, we were very involved in helping Burma as the country and also people on the ground. So because of what I have seen in my Burmese community, is really rooted for me to have a sense that, you know, Burmese people are very smart and very hardworking, very resilient, but also we have very limited resources. So when I get a chance to help my people, I always devoted my studies to help the Myanmar community again.
Right. Those are key parts of your journey. The being in a family that had that kind of social and political awareness, especially in coming from a closed and oppressive system like Burma, I can imagine how much that would have given you in your own growth and thought process. But I know another key part of where you came from and where you got to. I know this from looking at some of your past work and your interviews. Is your awareness of both privilege and discrimination in Burmese society. And I think that is something unique. I mean, that's a hard thing for anyone to look at, anyone with privilege in any society anywhere in the world that has a certain degree of discomfort in confronting that and taking it head on. And so I wonder if you can describe, first of all, how you would characterize the type of discrimination you see in Burmese society, and then how you came to understand and work with and acknowledge that.
Yeah, so when I was in Burma, you know, I was still a child, and I was not aware of my privilege as a Burmese person because Burmese are a majority in Burma, like white people in the U.S. So, you know, the system is set up for Burmese to thrive. And I was living in my own bubble, and I didn't understand how these privilege and power role play in our society. You know, when I saw other friends from different ethnic, they were not doing well. I just thought they were not smart enough to figure out the system, or they just, you know, I didn't realize the system was set up for them to be filled, right? So when I come to the U.S., I am a minority in the U.S. as a Burmese American, and the system is not set up for me to thrive. And even though I try probably 3 times harder than average white person, it seems like Asians are not looked at as leaders in the workplace. Also, there's a lot of microaggression, and I just starting to see the role reverse. So I have this empathy toward other ethnic people from my country, and I starting to see that, okay, you know, however we try, there's systematic barriers that is set up for ethnic not to thrive, and it is. So I see that power dynamic have shifted, and I am much more aware since I become a social worker, which we study mental health from the system point of view. So, you know, when I when I explain my clients about why they are suffering, I try to let them understand that, you know, we are not the disease. Mental health is not a disease. It's usually sometimes we are affected by the system.
Right. That's interesting. And I think that you're also, it's interesting seeing how you moved from feeling, from going from a place of privilege into a place where you did not have that privilege. And I think that also indicates that as complex beings in this world, no one has, or perhaps because there's no supreme ruler of the world, there's no one with absolute privilege and there's no one with absolute victimization. Where, and as we move and forth in different spaces and contexts, we have more or less privilege going from one place to another. And so it's, I think it's important to honor and appreciate this kind of complex way of where our privileges exert themselves and where they're lacking, so that we're not in black and white definitions. And with that in mind, I would invite you to share, when you referenced how you came to America and realized that you had to work three times harder than a white person and that there are these microaggressions, can you give some tangible examples of how you were doing as best as you can and working as hard as you could, and yet because it wasn't quite a totally fair system, that that you weren't getting the benefit that someone of a different background might?
Yeah, definitely. So I can give you a couple of examples. So, you know, although I have been living in the U.S. for about 18 years, I don't sound like Native American. I still have the strong Burmese accents. And that is a part of the discrimination when it's coming to when it's coming to competing for the resources. What I mean is that when we were applying for leadership position, you know, I am capable and I'm able to problem solve. I am able to lead and recruit people. But then when it's come to competing for the same position, this average white person might get that position because, you know, she or he is able to communicate as people are comfortable with, right? And also, like in a meeting room, I will be presenting with the same idea, but somebody might make it sounds same idea, and then just basically paraphrasing my idea, and then that person got the credit. And in those cases, you know, it seems rude if you call them out in the meeting. Hey, I just said that, and then you know. There are people who might give you credit. One of my guy's friend, he was like, no, it was Juju's idea. I just repeat it. You know, there are people who give you credit when it's due, but there are people who would just steal your idea and make it sound like theirs. So when it's come to those kind of like competing for the leadership's positions or opportunities, you know, we being as an Asian or Burmese American, we are very underlook, like we didn't get that same opportunities. But then, interestingly, when I come to Hawaii, when I move here to Hawaii, it seems like sky is limit. Like there's no question about my capacity to lead or teach, or there's no question. I am able to use all my potential to reach my highest capacity. It's basically because people in Hawaii are used to with accents, having this like different ethnic background. And we have majority of the ethnic here are Japanese, Chinese, Filipinos, Micronesian. And it seems like, you know, every system, there's some sort of social hierarchy and like dynamic and power play in every society, but it seems like all my potentials are able to utilize for the good cause in Hawaii.
Right. So that you started out by giving an example of how not so much language proficiency, but language accent played a role in certain kind of bias and privilege there. And so I want to ask you to flip that script. And if going back to the connections you made about discrimination in Burma, are there times that looking back that you realized that that same power dynamic was at play between ethnics and Bamar? And can you give us a concrete example of how you experienced that?
Yeah, totally. Because I just saw a video of another ethnic, like let's just say Karen. He couldn't speak Burmese fluently, and he was kind of like making fun of to speak Burmese acquittedly, you know, just because he couldn't speak Burmese, it doesn't mean he is not smart enough. He's not able to perform his work. Sometimes just because we're a dominated language, it doesn't mean that, and we have to understand that people who can speak more than one language have more struggle and being able to navigate the system. So yes, I have seen, not just on the video, but also I have seen some of my friends in Thai Burma border in Mesa when I used to live there. You know, just because they don't speak perfect Burmese, sometimes they're not given the same opportunities. So in my organization now, I am running for the community. I make sure that even people who don't speak perfect Burmese were given the same opportunity. When we hire interns or staff members, we make sure that their story is being highlighted. You know, if we don't understand different way of working, or you know, we're trying to learn from each other. I actually trying to educate myself when I work with different ethnics and their stories.
Right. It's interesting. And I think you're a voice and part of this younger Burmese generation that is trying to do things differently. And I want to string together some other voices we've had on this platform describing other takes that align with what you're saying. And that in previous generations in Myanmar, looking at what solidarity and inclusivity meant, it was there was always a kind of patronizing feeling of Bamar leaders with kind of like, you know, the cutesy ethnic traditions or clothes or something that just was more token style. And even in, you know, I've even had young Burmese friends share discomfort about, let's say, like Dr. Sasa's inclusion in the NUG as someone that is not really given the due respect and authority of some of the Burmese leaders, but is there as and I think there's other ethnic voices in the NUG that can point to that there's something that maybe they're a bit more than a token, but they're not quite, that the respect is not quite there. And yet what we see from this younger generation, in addition to what you're saying, there's three other examples that come to mind. Those are food, education, and language. And we have had other guests, Burmese guests, come on here and talk about each of those in language, in terms of wanting to be curious and not just wanting to make Burmese language instruction better to empower those ethnic communities, which is that's fine in and of itself, but also to want to go to those ethnic communities and speak their language and learn their language, which is not something I've heard in previous generations. Food, the idea that food is a sort of storytelling, and that there's a way to bring and honor ethnic foods and recipes and traditions of where they come from, and to be able to, when you enter into someone's food and you respect the food, it's a way of respecting the culture and where they come from. And then education, you know, entire education systems, Spring University Myanmar, among others, that are looking at how, you know, history and language and other types of subjects are being given to historically marginalized communities that can empower them and their sense of identity rather than denying it. So I think bringing all of those thoughts into what you're saying, I think this is culminating in these really different threads from this younger generation and trying to do things differently than has been done in previous decades.
Yeah, it's true, because you know Burma trying to become a federal state for so many years, and at least three different generations. I mean, as I can tell you that since my father's generation, without lack of trust and being able to understand from each other point of view, it's hard to build the federalism in our society. So, and a part of it is because we need to first acknowledge the different ethnic background. It's not just the facts, but also the mindset, the respect that we have to pay each other. You know, it's easier to say than done. What I mean by that is, you know, when I work closely with some Karini women organizations and churches and youth, and I mean, in the Karini area, there's so many ethnicities and languages and food culture and clothing, and I'm still trying to figure it out how to, you know, learning the culture and philosophies and different way of living. And so when I don't know, I have to be honest and be humble about it. I'm not trying to be like, oh, I am the one trying to help you. No, like, we're working together. We're trying to figure out the answer together, how to help communities together. So it's come to being aware of the differences and power and privilege. And also, when it is not my place, I need to give up my seat. What I mean is that, for example, I live in Hawaii, and there's also a lot of privilege. Well, I use a lot of privilege in my languages, because it's very truly honor to see how societies works. So for example, I work with Native Hawaiians in the hospital and community setting as well. And one of my colleagues, she was Native Hawaiian clinician, and she helped to rebuild her community from the wildfire in Maui. And she has been doing an amazing job. She, you know, I didn't know her that well, but I know that she need to be, she deserve respect, and she deserve acknowledgement, recognition. So when I was serving at the board of directors at National Association of Social Work, I nominated her for a national award. And, you know, although I'm also trying very hard for my Myanmar community, I am not gonna be like, hey, I deserve an award too. No, like, she, this is her work. She need to be recognized for her nation. So what I mean is that when we talk about advocacy and social justice and, you know, like, recognition where your place is, and sometimes we have to give up our seat, sometimes we have to you know, clear the path for next generation, next person to come along.
And I want to return and ask a question about your upbringing and conditioning to better understand as you move through these cultures and your family environment. And I want to ask a somewhat sensitive question, because I know that in Myanmar, there's been this history of, in previous generations, of those, especially Bamar, who were advocating for the democracy movement and human rights and political prisoners and everything else. There has sometimes been a less sensitive understanding of the ethnic struggles. And I think we saw this come out most obviously and blatantly with the Rohingya crisis. And there was a lot of confusion from the outside community, how longtime advocates of democracy and human rights that had been victimized by the military were very much not on the side of the Rohingyas that had faced more or less the same thing. And so I'm just curious, to whatever degree you feel comfortable sharing, as you grew up in a very politically and socially conscious family home, to what degree was this sensitivity of the ethnic struggles a part of your understanding of the wider aspirations and hopes for the country and society? And to what degree was it reflective maybe of the time and place and generation, and that you had to go through your own learning process to realize that there was maybe a further degree that you had to go in terms of what you were looking to build and what your awareness wanted to be?
Mm. Well, growing up in Burma, you know, it seems like Rohingya or Indian Burmese were looked at as a second-class citizen, right? They didn't even get a citizenship. They were living with their foreign card. So it's kind of like a green card in the U.S., right? So we didn't really associate with them that much. And there was an enriched social classes in the Myanmar society, and especially in Rangoon where I live. Because I remember Indian Burmese were like, low labor class. And they were like, when I was in school, they were carrying our like lunch basket and that kind of service they provided. So we didn't know, like I was not taught to associate with them. So there is already between like them and we division, this, you know, they're split in that same society, right? So, but it didn't sit well as a kid. Like, you know that something is not right because they're carrying your basket, but you don't really talk to them or you're not really understanding their language either. So it's just like I'm growing up just being curious about like, why don't we associate with our neighbor? You know, they are also providing services for Burmese people. So, you know, as a kid, you don't question much. You just kind of like live by until, you know, I'm more curious about war orders and all these different dynamic in the Burmese culture and society. So that's like rooted in my curiosity, right? And then when is Rohingya crisis hit? And it also doesn't seem right that, you know, they have been living in Burma for decades and they don't get to call themselves a citizen or any rights given. And it, that when we learn the complexity, it's still hard to wrap your head around, like, what is going on this, you know, region in Rakhine State and how many people have been displaced in Bangladesh. And I have some colleagues who lives in Rakhine State and also in Bangladesh. You know, it just seems like there's so much trauma and suffering in this community that I can't even imagine. And, you know, I'm not trying to be political here and I don't understand the complexity of this history, but I understand when I see pain and this community have suffered too long and they have reached out for healing process and they have reached out for helping the Rohingya community and, you know, mental health crisis. So, as a human being and as a mental health professionals, there's something that we need to pay attention in this community as well.
Right. And so we've spent some time talking about discrimination and the different levels of privilege and ethnic backgrounds, both in Burma and what you faced in the U.S. Another area of your concern has been patriarchy. And so can you describe the nature of how you see the patriarchy operating in Burma and how you've tried to speak out against it?
Sometimes we think patriarchy is important to protect our identity. But sometimes it also create like hate crimes and very unhealthy behaviors in our systems. So, you know, just because we love who we are and protect our identity, it doesn't mean we need to harm other people's rights or violate their rights, violate them as who they are. And we have to be mindful of the fine line between this love and hate of patriarchy. So, you know, it seems like, you know, this word is very used in the way that to promote their nationalism, to promote our own interests as a nation. And I see that in Myanmar and also elsewhere as in the U.S. And especially the war seem to be swinging back to the right wings. And we need to be very careful of like how we are using this word to promote our community leaders' interests. And when I say leaders, you know, it can be chosen or not chosen leaders. And we need to be intentional about how we are using words and ideologies to take advantage of people.
Mm-hmm, right. So in your advocacy in wanting to identify patriarchy in Burma, and I guess we could also say in US, what have you been focused on wanting to call attention to, and what kind of changes would you like to see?
That's a tough question. Yeah. Yeah. I think, again, you know, we are all different. You know, just because I'm Burmese and you're American, or like, we can't just use this word to benefit one group over another. What I would like to see in any society is that, you know, diversity is beautiful, but at this time of day and age, like, diversity is not very encouraged. It seems like, you know, one nationalism is better than others, and we just need to be mindful and be careful of how we are trying to be different, but also we are also the same at the in the end. So the things that I would like to see in my generation is that, you know, we have seen beauties in diversity, and we have been lived in some degree of melting pot culture. And I think if we're able to bring back those values, it can be beautiful. But I think the direction that our society is going, it seems to be a little bit more dangerous.
Yeah, definitely, that for sure. And now, staying with the focus on Burma, it's largely a Buddhist country. There are a lot of other minority religions and communities that are there, but the majority is Buddhist. And so I'd like to ask you if Buddhism played a role in your family background, or if it's played a role in your life, Buddhist principles or meditation, as well as where you see the wider organized religion of Buddhism playing, what kind of role you see it playing, what kind of varied role you could say you see it playing in wider Burmese society.
Oh yeah, definitely. I see Buddhist philosophies playing, especially in things that I do, and also in mental health field. And, you know, like, when it's come to philosophy and organized religions, we need to be able to differentiate. What I mean by that is, yes, Buddhism is very well-organized religions, and it seems to be the, you know, dominated culture that is also, again, the systematic setup for Buddhism to thrive in Burma. But if we look at it, every religion in Burma, whether Christianity, Hinduism, Islamic, it's all based on love and kindness and compassion. So, you know, if we really, like, especially now, I would like to speak up for the Islamic people who lost life during the earthquake. They were praying in their mosque, but the news highlight is not very giving attention to this community and population. Because, you know, and again, when it's come to the earthquake victims in Burma, some people are saying that, oh, you know, people are not religious enough, that's why God didn't protect you. No, these people were praying. They were being religious. And we have to be mindful of, like, everything we say and we are communicating, and what philosophy is based in, and what kind of culture we are creating. So, again, you know, yes, Buddhism is very well organized in Burma, but the philosophy base itself is actually very balanced. And if we look at it and we're able to practice the middle path, we can find the balance.
Mm-hmm, right. So this is a point where we can segue from your analysis and background in the role of that discrimination has played in various societies in Burma and US, the two that you've lived in, and Thailand as well, to add a third. And then the very interesting bridge that you make between that phenomenon and where mental health comes in, because you have described how the nature of these inequities and this discrimination and this oppression and this this unfairness that that is systemic in some of these societies, how that gives way to mental disorders, to trauma, to mental imbalance. And that's where you've come in with your safe space to be able to play a role. And so I think that's very interesting, because you're not just looking at how to provide mental healing and health as an experience in and of itself, but you're postulating on the root causes of where this comes from and making that connection. So describe that bridge as you define it to our audience.
Yeah. So I started this Juju Safe Space because I didn't have any safe people or safe person, safe space to share my struggles as a young person. And I mean, there are struggles within families, my family. You know, as you can imagine, my dad being a political prisoner, he has so much trauma and nightmares and behavior issues, and that affect me personally. And then in the society, I see things around me. There are so much dysfunctional as a society. Burmese people are easily escalated, and you know, they are. It seems like they don't have a lot of coping strategies to deal with, you know, anger or when they're distressed, and it's affect the way we communicate with each other and trust issues and how the society is functioning. And it's so I started this safe space to just basically share my struggles and also point out what's going on in our community. And then so I started that page in 2019, and then when the pandemic hit, people reaching out to me for the professional support. So with my background in mental health professions, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it properly. I'll provide services and trainings to my community. So I registered it in Hawaii State to provide services for Myanmar people. So I started providing, like, you know, trainings and giving more lectures, webinars. And then it started bigger and bigger. And then we started to see this trends of suicide cases just keep increasing. And especially I work in the hospital, where we also see a lot of mental health, mental illnesses due to substance use and systematic abuse and, broken families and all these things. So I'm like, okay, you know, my profession in the hospital can be a bridge between these two communities that I would like to serve. So I use these curriculum and skill set that is U.S. standard procedure and protocol to make sure that I'm providing the best quality service for Myanmar people too. Because sometimes you may notice that when it's come to serving people in third world country, people just give this watered down, washed down services and quality. And I think Myanmar and Burmese people in Burma deserve to receive the best service as well. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, in Juju Safe Space, we provide good quality international standard services to Myanmar people as well. And also I want to make sure that they understand that we are not weak when we talk about mental illnesses. Mental disorder is a part of the suffering. And why do we suffer? I try to help them to understand the root cause of the systematic discrimination and just distribution. Trying to pinpoint that, you know, this is not just happening during the pandemic or because of the coup. It's rooted in generationals, you know. It's rooted from all the times that, I mean, as we can even imagine, we never talk about these things throughout the generations. My grandfather had an anger issue. It's because, you know, he went through traumatic events as a child. And we don't talk about it. We just treat people as who they are based on these behaviors. you know, when people are starting to become aware of these mental illnesses and disease, we also need to be make sure that we're not treating or we're not labeling people based on the mental illness either. So, you know, it's important to pinpoint that we're not the disease or we're not these behavior. We are a part of the system because we live in a society that we are connected to each other. We play important role in each other's lives and contribute to the facts that we are also a part of the problem, but we are also a part of the solution.
So there's something really interesting in what you said when you were talking about wanting to get to the roots of suffering and not just the experiences of a coup or a pandemic or an earthquake. These are not light experiences for most of humanity, we should say. But, you know, you're wanting to get beyond the phenomenon of the experience that's overtaking us and get at this root cause of where the suffering comes from. And that's a very interesting turn of phrase. And it brings up two different dynamics in my mind. And I'm wondering if these are dynamics that you're balancing in your understanding of the roots of suffering, or if there's one you're leaning towards more. One being, of course, anytime one is talking about the root of suffering, one can't but think of the Buddha. And because if the Four Noble Truths, if the Buddha taught one thing, it's the understanding of the arising of suffering, its nature and its cessation, and the road to liberation. And this is a spiritual, some would say a religious path, for many spiritual though, and in looking at the experience of human suffering as it exists in any time and place, and trying to understand and come out of that. Another way to look at this root of suffering is through any number of social or political lenses over the last number of centuries, anything from Marx to Paulo Freire, and looking at, you know, his understanding of the nature of oppression and in unequal systems and the experience of societies that are privileging one class over another, and systemic bias that continues unabated and sometimes increases over time. As you're trying to treat the root cause and identifying what the symptoms are, but wanting to get at that root cause of what lay at the heart of that suffering, to what degree is your model, or you personally, looking at this this more Buddhist and spiritual lens, and then looking at some of the more social and political analyses of where human inequity comes from in society and how to deal at that root level as well?
Wow, that's an excellent questions and analysis. So yeah, you nailed it. So I'm talking from the social and political structure and landscape. Yeah. So, I mean, even before the British colonialism, there's so much death and hate from the, you know, kingdoms and all these tribes that Burma was built on. So there's a lot of fears and hate between each other. And again, you know, I would like to clarify that I am not treating the root cause. I'm just trying to help people to understand the root cause. We can only treat the symptoms and make people feel better about suffer from their suffering. And when it's come to a Buddhist philosophy of suffering, of course, suffering always exists. We just need to learn how to cope with that. And, you know, there's a philosophy that I really like. It's also from the dialectical behavior therapy, which is based from the Japanese Zen Buddhism. Is basically, you know, if we put it in an equation, and, you know, when we put pain and acceptance, it's just pain. But if we put pain and rejection together, it becomes suffering. So if we just accept, it's just life, it's just a part of life, it's a part of, you know, human experience, and it just as it is. But if we are like looking at it as like, oh my God, it's happening to me. Why me? If we just playing pity party and we're not wanting to deal with that, then it becomes suffering and it becomes bigger. And when it's become bigger, we need to be able to deal with that and cope with it and find ways to figure it out. That's when it's come to mental health services come in. Because in my generation, we have the time and knowledge to deal with these things now. You know, we didn't want to deal with this throughout the generations. We didn't want to talk about it. When we talk about it, you know, are you crazy? Are you insane? You're not the only one. You know, this is not the only one happening. Everybody's suffering. It's just life. You know, just suck it up, move on. So we got tough it out, but we never really got a chance to process it as a society, as a community. Now we are starting to open it about, you know, being able to normalize it, talking about it, and being able to understand it. It's just very beginning of the mental health movement. So it's a great opportunity for us to start, you know, healing all these intergenerational like trauma and the root cause of our suffering.
Right. And looking at these last 5 years of life for many Burmese and what's gone on in Myanmar, to say nothing of what came before, the generational trauma and persecution and tyranny that happened in the country that we'll get to in a moment. But just looking through the last 5 years, I mean, you had the pandemic, and okay, the pandemic was in many places. It was especially bad in Myanmar, but it was a global phenomenon. Then you had the military coup and 4 years of ensuing violence, and then you had the earthquake. I mean, these are three profound events happening in a short time that many people will never experience one in their lives. And then between that, you have things like flooding or just the loss of home for so many people, the exile in one place or another, displacement, the collapsed economy, I've mentioned the ongoing violence, but I mean, that really can't be understated of just how extreme that's been. This is just such a compounding of pain. And I appreciate what you just said about having agency, having acceptance, being able to have an experience of pain, but be free from the mental anguish of it. I mean, that's other types of Buddhist thinking and principles, is how there could be pain, and then there could be the prolonged mental anguish that can, and that's something that can be shortened and lessened with work. Yet at the same, and I think those principles apply regardless. They apply if you're in a concentration camp. They apply if you're a political prisoner. They apply if you're displaced. They're much harder to be able to have the resilience to find and capture them, but they're still possible for the human experience, however far away they might be. But I'm recalling with this the words of a recent podcast guest we had, Theory, who came on and described how there's eight realms of hell in the Burmese Buddhist understanding, and that some Burmese are using dark humor right now to say, well, the ninth level of hell is now Myanmar. We have now entered a ninth level of hell that we have founded, that was not known to exist in the universe until we just had one crisis on top of another. And so talk about just the extent of how extreme and compounded these last 5 years have been for the Burmese people in country as well as out, and handling basically alone this level of absolute crisis that many people wouldn't even see one in their lifetime. Talk about that. But then with that, talk about how your methods and understanding still can apply even in what we're seeing now is really the most extreme of circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, man, talk about that. We don't get a break at all.
Yeah.
I mean, one crisis after another, it's become like these stressors in our life. It become chronic and it's hard to deal with, but we just have to deal with that. We don't have an option not to deal with that, right? So, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of people lost family members and loved ones, including my parents. And then we have these coup, and then we have, you know, the flooding, earthquake, and all these things. That's just, you know, if you want to be religious about it, it's like another testimony of our resilience. If we want to talk about from the mental health landscape, and it's just like, we just have to keep building our resiliency, yet And of course, we got to acknowledge the suffering and the pain that, you know, people inside Myanmar want. It's been going through. And it is even painful for me to watch it from the far distance. Because people who love Burma, we all get affected, whether you're Burmese or you're American or, you know, because this is such a beautiful country and people are just, you know, very heartwarming people. We don't deserve this kind of pain, constant pain. And that's why, you know, especially when we're dealing with crisis and the life that we have to deal with, it's important that we're aware of how we're coping with that. Otherwise, what happened, what we see is that people starting to self-medicate by using substance, mind-altering, you know, substance to deal with that. And it's create more chaos in the community. People will use it, even glue, to get high. I have seen young children like 10 years old, 11 years old, just sniffing glue just to get high, just don't want to deal with this pain because it is painful. And therefore, you know, we need to be able to talk about these, acknowledge it, accept it. Even the present is being so painful to accept it. That's the only way we got to pass through the pain, is to accept and be able to process it. So if we don't process it, if we don't allow the pain, if we don't allow this anger to come out and all these ugly stuff, yucky stuff to come out, it's just gonna suppress, and then we become numb and we don't talk about these things. It become, you know, a wound in our mind, and it's become trauma. So that's why yesterday we just gave a preventing secondary trauma for a humanitarian worker. We gave a training about that, and we want to make sure people understand that these are preventable. Trauma is preventable. The way we do is that we allow this pain to pass through our body and our mind and our brain, so that way we don't suffer too long.
Right. And I think going back to the last number of years, when I'm thinking of the first week of February 2021, so many things rock the nation and rock those that were that had some relationship with the country and the people. And I think that one of the things that stood out to me immediately after the coup was that there was a sentiment that I was seeing online and from friends and videos and whatnot, of people basically saying some version of, I'm not okay. I'm not okay that this happened. I'm not happy. And that immediately was an important bookmark to be able to capture, that I think those that might not be so attuned to Myanmar society might not see as something standing out. But to me, it stood out immediately. And for that, I want to give some context. I was, before the transition, I worked as a trainer at the American Center in Yangon. And the style of training that I did, we would have an experience in the classroom. And then after the experience, we would talk in our group about how people felt about that experience. The experiences weren't anything. Sometimes they might be something a bit more profound and intense, but often they were simple experiences simple workshops that would just be working on this learning model or this concept that we'd want to learn, but we'd be doing it experientially and reflectively. And so then we would ask after the session was done, you know, what people thought of it and how they learned from it and how they felt, especially how they felt during it, because this was part of the experience, was their integration into this this workshop. And in my early months in Myanmar, I wouldn't get very solid critical feedback in return when I would ask this. It was always, we enjoyed it, or we thought this was nice. And so I had to really work to get I statements from participants that would take ownership into how they felt and also be comfortable in simply describing, like, I didn't like this part of the workshop because it made me feel like this, or I was sleepy and I wanted to move around and be active, and because I just had to sit and listen, I wasn't so engaged. Just some kind of critical feedback that was able to take ownership over something that wasn't entirely positive, some aspect of the experience that was like, I didn't like this so much, or I would have liked this, or this made me feel this way. And that was a major breakthrough, to be able to design workshops that empowered them to be able to say those things and feel safe in saying them. And so I was very attuned to this expression of, I'm not okay, that that this was something that was very, that I heard very seldom in my time in Myanmar, and even from close friends, very seldom would this phrase be uttered, and I think even held in the mind. And so when the coup took place, and we started hearing variations all over social media and other places of people saying in their own way, I'm not okay, to me, this was like a watershed moment that I was very aware and attuned to. I wonder your thoughts on this time, and if this was something you noticed as well.
Oh, yeah, totally. We just talked about it in my support group yesterday, because previously, you know, we were not given permission to check in with ourselves. You know, generationally and culturally, we're just told how we're supposed to feel. You know, our parents don't ask how we're feeling. Are we okay or not? You know, this is how you're supposed to feel. And that's it, right? So we learn to reserve our feelings and our experience. But now, you know, whether it's the cultural shift or people are more connected to the Western world, or, you know, I would say during the Aung San Suu Kyi's time, a lot of young generation are able to connect with like outside world, because the education level is also higher. We're able to speak English and connect with the world. And that's really shift the mindset. It's okay to express ourselves. And we're giving ourselves permission to just express, I'm not okay. I'm speaking up for myself. I'm, you know, the way I created my Facebook page. Yeah, my family is not listening to me, so I'm going to talk to people who listen to me, and I'm going to express myself. I was discouraged to speak up for myself. So yes, it's a totally cultural shift. From then, you know, we see like a lot of different way of expressing I'm not okay, to the acceptance of it is okay not to be okay. So now we're normalizing that, okay, we're not okay, but, you know, it is a part of our experience, and we're trying to, starting from presenting the problem to trying to look for the solution together. So now that's why I think mental health is playing such a big role in that. Okay, if we're not okay, what do we do about it? Because we don't want to live in this mindset of survival mode all the time, because exhausting. It is. Right. It's not a way to live. So I am trying to start training people from shifting to surviving to thriving. Yet we are trying to survive in these crises. Yet we are still facing a lot of challenges with, you know, natural disaster, the oppression, the war, ongoing civil war. But we still need to thrive in this system. We can't just be play all the time by the system. We need to be player to change the system. So it's a mindset, and the culture is shifting.
Yeah, and I appreciate that sense of agency that you're putting into your treatment. And I think that sense of that I'm not okayness, as much as that's a watershed moment, it's also the start of something, and there's a lot more that comes after it. That's not enough in and of itself. That's not to diminish the importance of how profound it is to live in a society where, because of patriarchy or bias or discrimination or just flat out military oppression, one has not been able to articulate certain things, not being given inner permission to think certain things, to suddenly say and think and acknowledge, I'm not okay. This is such a profound and important moment, I would say, in the history of Myanmar, to really look at as a before and after moment. But it's also not enough. It's the start of something, but more is needed. I'm not the mental health professional. I know that more is needed, but I don't know what that more is. So as the mental health professional, can you tell us what more is needed after that acknowledgement that comes next?
First of all, we need a lot more qualified, well-trained mental health professionals. What that mean by that is, you know, we need to create opportunity and space for young professionals to become professionally trained. When I say professional three times in a row is that because mental health became trendy in Burma and also in Thailand. But then it's also kind of a dangerous zone. People are, you know, learning techniques and trainings, and then they try to become counselors and therapists and you know, without proper trainings and supervisions, educations, it's a dangerous place to play. We don't want to be in that place. You know, we need to create scholarship opportunities, learning programs to have qualified mental health professionals to help our Myanmar community. Therefore, you know, yeah, it seems like the demand is so high. So there is an excuse in our mental health field in Myanmar that, you know, we need to just serve people with what we have. I mean, my profound ideas is that I value mental health and philosophies and techniques. I don't want it to be watered down and, you know, providing and qualifying services to Myanmar people, because I value the Myanmar people. And it's just, I don't want to see people suffering more from people doing unethical things and messing people's life. You know, when you have toothache, you know, you can go to see a dentist and you can just pick out, oh, this tooth is hurting, I can just take it out. But when it's come to mental health, it's so complex. You got to understand human development, the culture, the belief system, the core value, the way we grow up, the political system that we grew up with, and the mindset, all very complex. And again, now we're trying to understand the connection between neuropsychology. So that's why I want to make sure that, you know, we are making space and also creating opportunity to bring more qualified mental health professionals in the Myanmar community.
Uh-huh. I want to ask another sensitive question, and I'm sure this is something you've dealt with. And when we're looking at providing mental health care to, and also understanding and compassion for victims, that comes natural and easy for many of us because it's so obvious how they've suffered and what kind of help they need. But another just as critical, some would argue much more critical, and yet also sensitive and harder for some to get their mind around, is mental health care for the aggressor. Because, and I think this is where also Buddhist understanding comes. This is, I mean, when I learned this through meditation practice, it was something that really changed my life, is the understanding that in many, if not all cases, one is causing harm because there's some mental disorder or other in the mind. And as much as we might want to hate it or to block it or to cancel it or to just push it away, and in some degrees and in some extreme cases, of course, you have to. So for protection of society, there are measures you have to take. But there is also an experience of being able to treat it and being able to get into, whether we're talking about aggressor as someone in privilege and in an unfair system, a dictatorial military, a rapist, a soldier committing atrocities. I mean, we can go on and on of the type of aggressors that we're talking about, but, you know, there is a linkage to the extreme behaviors they're doing and the mental disorders that aren't being treated and the treatment and compassion that we can try to generate for those committing these wrong behaviors and to try to work towards. And that is hard. You know, that is hard for a lot of us. Is that something, especially in Myanmar society, you've put your attention to? And how has that experience been for you, if so? And how has it been received by the wider society?
I mean, to be honest, we're not there yet. What I mean by that is, you know, when clients come to seek help, we don't choose who we want to help. We're trying to not our bias to influence our practice. However, as a clinician and as a human being, I'm not there yet. It takes a lot of courage to face the oppressor. And it's true that the oppressor, the aggressor, is the one who is really need to be treated. But the thing is, I don't think they think they're the problem, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't acknowledge your problem, where do we start with that? Obviously, we see that how Miao Lai has been insecure around Aung San Suu Kyi, and he's threatened by her power, threatened by woman power especially. And that's why he did everything in his power to take back her power, right? And everybody see that clearly. He is very insecure, short little man. But again, you know, he's using his weapons and guns to take control of the country and killing thousands of people. And, you know, we have to fight back. And again, if we want to treat these people, they need to come and seek help. And the only way they're seeking help is from their religions, being religiously preoccupied by undoing what they have done. So, you know, as a society, we're not there yet. As a clinician, we're not there yet. It will take a lot of awareness in the society to get there.
Is that something that you personally would feel comfortable in addressing if there was that openness on the other side?
Not right now. Right now, my focus is to help the people who have been being oppressed. Eventually, maybe when I am a lot more experienced and being able to see the oppressor side, I could. But the imbalance is such a huge gap in between, and yeah. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think we're also in an active conflict zone. And as you answer that, it makes me think of in any kind of post-military future for Myanmar, this is when this is going to become so important, the looking at reconciliation and healing and being able to at that time to treat people in an appropriate way, because certainly when you're in an active conflict zone where atrocities are continuing to take place every day, it's a bit harder to even think of where any kind of treatment or dialogue would come when that's not happening in any form right now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when the political tone changed, maybe one is softer when there is some acknowledge of what they have done or apologies to the public. Maybe, you know, we may find some common ground. But right now, it stay active war, and I don't see any kind of reconciliation. And no. I mean, especially there's earthquake happening, and there was 2 weeks ceasefire, and their actions show the otherwise.
Sure.
So there's no way that I am there to open to treating the oppressor yet.
Yeah, and we also have to separate between the generals and elite at the top of the military and the soldiers that are, for whatever reason, have found themselves in rank, and their lives are certainly not so good in terms of the fodder that they're treated with. But yet there's a lot of military conditioning that that they have gone through. And I think it is, as hard as it might be to generate compassion for those that are on the side of atrocities, there does come this understanding of an appreciation for just the degree of trauma and of conditioning and brainwashing, really, that they've gone through. And to say that, certainly not as any excuse, but as an acknowledgement of how hard the process of undoing that would be from a mental health standpoint.
Oh, yeah, totally. I want to clarify that. You know, when it's come to CDM soldiers, I help them. You know, when they are ready to get help, you know, we're ready to help them. So when we talk about oppressor and aggressor, we're talking about the elite of the military.
Sure. Yeah, right. Now, let's go back to your page, Juju's Safe Spaces. You mentioned how you started that in 2019, and it's grown since. We've learned a lot about your methodology and your beliefs and what you're trying to do. But if we can get a bit more tangible and technical in terms of how the page has grown into whatever it is today and where you would like to seek, where you would like to see it grow beyond that, as well as how you're actually interacting on this page, what services you're providing, what help you're giving, and what those that are coming to the page, what they can expect to find there.
You know, as the name is supposed to be a safe space, and what that means is that safe space for people who are being oppressed, safe space for people who are seeking, you know, inner peace. And our mission is to build inner peace toward national peace. And therefore, you know, I am very transparent with what I stand for, what my vision is, what we are trying to envision as the society. So, however, because of the political climate and the way that I express politically, people in Myanmar seem to be a bit hesitate to interact with us because of their security, right? I totally understand that. So, but we also want to make sure that, you know, we are creating a platform that is open with transparency to talk about the root cause of mental disorders in our society. So what I would like to see is that mental health is not just trending because of all these intense crisis that we are seeing and we are experiencing. Mental health is a journey, something that we need to commit it. And as an organization, as a profession, we're taking it as a movement. So therefore, we are doing all these things that in different levels of commitment. So we do provide individual help. And also, you know, in the community, we do community building, support group, also like educational platforms, you know, providing conferences with international community. So like January 2025, we were collaborating with Chiang Mai University in Thailand. And we have like clinicians from four different countries, the US, Thailand, Myanmar, And we were working together to find peace within our community. And when it's come to peace, you know, we have to build within ourselves, and then we, you know, spread it around our people around us, our community, our leaders. And when we talk about all these mental health, we can't change the system without profound policy. So we need to be able to bring communities, leaders, as well as governments to change these mental health policies. And again, we're not there yet. We're trying to include NUGs and Ministry of Health, but we were not able to invite them due to the scheduling conflict. So we're hoping that we will reach to the society where humans being are being provided with resources and policies are protecting our mental health rights. Because I mean, if we go back to basic thing, mental health is not seen as physical health as well. Mm-hmm. So we need to play back and forth with different levels of advocacy and commitment.
So you're seeing this focus of mental health on as an important track on the healing of the future of Myanmar. And towards those ends, you're wanting the rightful authorities as they're operating now and as they will hopefully operate soon in the future to take that on as the priority that you see it. And you mentioned how they those from the health department, the NUG's health department, could not come because of scheduling conflicts. But beyond that, what willingness have you seen from the NUG or other authorities to want to take this as seriously as you think it should be? And what confidence do you have in how they might be willing to adapt or to work with you in some of these goals that you have?
I mean, I see some commitment from the NUG, especially they have this health line called Telegemma. You know, they have the counseling services, mental health division. So I work with some of the psychiatrists and counselor from their mental health department as well. So I see some commitment toward that. Also, I work with UN agencies and international governments to bring mental health peace in every project that they're working with the Myanmar community. And at the UN Women, I have mentioned that, you know, if we want to bring democracy and transitional justice, we need to start from the ground. We need to be able to build trust within leaders and communities, to be able to build trust, to be able to put our guard down. We need to find way to heal ourselves first. So it's go back and forth of like individual to the society, you know, is the interrelated issues. So that's why I'm trying to advocate to get more programs and services that can integrate to community programs.
So it sounds like your Juju's Safe Spaces on Facebook started out as a Facebook page in a virtual form. It sounds like it has really blossomed and grown beyond the virtual and beyond the social media into being something not just aspirational, but also very much in the physical, practical realm and in moving beyond those virtual spaces and actually into people in rooms and programs and advocacy and such.
Yeah, if you put it that way, it's been such a blossoms and it's such a amazing experience to witness what Myanmar society is ready for. You know, it started as a Facebook page, we're just communicating virtually, and then now we are providing community mental health programs and working with different agencies and governments and women leaders, and I can see how much it is needed and how much work we need to do, and I'm happy to do so.
This is a lot of work, and it's developing from a side project of a passion project or hobby to want to just have something online into something that could be a full-time job or beyond a full-time job. Have you been able to work to secure funding and to be able to enact all that it is that you're doing and want to do?
Oh, thank you for asking that. It started out as my passion project and I was paying my staff member out of my salary. And then I'm just like asking this auntie, this uncle to, you know, provide for conferences and guest speakers. And then, you know, there are people starting to see it is evidence-based practice that's working for the Myanmar community. So then I don't really have any grant or any secure funding, but I have a few donors that really believe in my mission and they have been supportive of this Juju Safe Space mission to build inner peace toward national peace. And hopefully more people will hear this and hopefully more people will support. And again, you know, there are a lot of opportunities that we were able to we were hoping to secure, but then, you know, the political dynamic shifted. What I'm saying is with the US aid cut, it's really hard to get funding for mental health. And again, you know, when it's come to mental health, it's become like a second priority. But to be honest, you know, without the fuel, without this resilience, without all this hope that we're trying to build in people, we can't really run the engine, right? So we need to make sure that people understand the importance of mental health and how we are functioning as human beings.
Right, certainly. And I can definitely identify with what started as a kind of virtual passion project and interest went into something much more. That's true of our whole platform right now as well. All of this started with a humble blog spot in 2012 when I was in Myanmar and I was just spending time visiting different monasteries and meditation centers for extended periods and learning a lot of interesting stories and simply wanting to write down and record my experiences. I saw it as kind of an online journal. In my case, I didn't even know there was a readership out there. I wasn't writing to want to appeal to others. In the case of what I was doing, it was more of just wanting to record my own thoughts and have them captured online. And that, because no one was doing that kind of thing at that time, that caught on, and that led to the whole thing of what we're doing now with where our podcast has come and our humanitarian project and everything else. So there is a kind of symmetry there that's interesting of starting something that you really love and care about, and you're just doing it because you love doing it, and then suddenly it grows because of conditions that you could never anticipate. It grows into something else and have an outsized impact that you never could have dreamed of at that moment. But now that you are at this stage, and now that you are at this moment in time of seeing what you've come from and what you've gone to, you must also be somewhat envisioning of what could lie ahead, and of bigger dreams and ambitions and aspirations of what you could achieve, given the progress you've made thus far. And so how would you describe that? What you've gone into that a little bit, of just how you want mental health to be something that is taken more seriously as a national priority that authorities are working towards. But can you go into a bit more detail about this thing, this program, this movement that you've helped to create and that's gathered momentum? Where would you like to see it go in 5 or 10 years?
I mean, in 5 or 10 years, you know, we got to be really working hard to where I envision. What I mean by that is we still need a lot of programs and services that people can utilize. And it's also playing interchangeable with the political atmosphere. If we are able to restore the democracy and be able to go back to Burma, you know, we could probably establish like outpatient treatment programs, substance use treatment program, you know, mental health trainings every single day, and just, you know, putting these mental health podcasts and TV and talk shows as a part of our daily life activities. If we're not able to go back to Burma yet, and especially, you know, we are trying to do a lot of work from outside of the country, we need to build strong foundations. And when the time is right, it's just gonna blossom right away. So we have to, you know, plant the seed with good intention that mental health is not something that people can just play like a playground. You know, it is a professional, and it is something that we are training properly and preparing for something's about to change.
That's a very good answer. And I thank you very much for coming on here to tell your journey and the journey of your program and share that.
But thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my, you know, vision for Myanmar society. I want to see Myanmar society with, you know, healthy coping skills and finding a peace and harmony, because we have so much resilience and we have gone through a lot. And that's not something that one person can take, but we take it anyway, because that's the only way we are able to survive. But you know, like I said in the beginning, we got to find a way from surviving to thriving again. We're going to shine again. We're gonna be able to lead the nation and this nation towards the international community. We're going to be, you know, being a shining star in the world again. It's just the hope that we cannot give up. So to be able to, you know, fire this hope and burn this fuel, and you save space as a fuel behind the engines, that engine's gonna run. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being a part of this conversation and joining our global community of listeners. At Insight Myanmar Podcast, we see our platform as a space where stories, reflections, and experiences come together to create deeper understanding and foster meaningful connections. Each conversation is an invitation to strengthen the ties that reveal our shared humanity, which is grounded in a care towards Myanmar and its people. And this work is made possible only through the generosity and support of listeners like you. Your contributions enable us to continue amplifying these voices, sharing these important stories, and connecting us all through the power of dialogue. And so by giving, you're not just supporting a production, you're actively nurturing a growing community of insight and compassion. If you found value in what we share, we invite you to help sustain and expand this platform. Every donation, no matter the size, helps us to keep this effort alive. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a contribution and be a part of this shared journey.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,